The painter Audrey Flack once said, "We need art because it helps us deal with our mortality.
It helps us make sense out of all the pain and the suffering and the joy that we deal with as human beings." Art, especially for Audrey, but I mean, for her creating it and for the rest of us, however we express ourselves or appreciating art, it's what helps us understand the human condition.
That's filmmaker Deborah Schaefer. We talk with her about Queen of Hearts, her wonderful documentary about the life and work of Audrey Flack. Then we talk with the film's editor and co-director, Rachel Reichman, about making the Queen of Hearts and documentaries in general.
The extraordinary thing about a documentary is you can have an agenda about what the film is about. And of course, certainly you pick your subject and it will be the subject. But in terms of what the film is really about, I think actually to make a decent film, you need to put aside your preconceived ideas and you must simply allow yourself to see what's in the can.
Finally, we talk with investigative journalist Greg Palast about the important victory he just won in court to force the governor of Georgia to release the details of a huge purge of mostly African-American voters in the 2018 election. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for a free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. At 88 years old, Audrey Flack holds a unique place in the history of contemporary art in America. Feminist, rebel, mother, painter, sculptor, and teacher, Flack's often controversial 40-year career evolved from abstract expressionism in the 1950s to photorealism in the 1970s. One of the first women ever included in the famed Janssen's History of Art, Audrey Flack continues to create, explore, and inspire with her unique style and indomitable spirit. Filmmaker Deborah Schaefer was inspired by Flack's life to explore the question of how artists, especially women artists, keep creating throughout their lives. Her film, Queen of Hearts, follows Audrey Flack as she takes her work in a brand new direction and reveals her long-term struggles as the mother of a child with autism. The stunning film is a moving portrait of an artist who is still testing, still experimenting, and still searching. Deborah Schaefer has been making social issue documentaries since the early 1970s, including the Academy Award winner Witness to War, and the award-winning films Fire from the Mountain and Dance of Hope, among others. Well, Deborah Schaefer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This is just such a wonderful film, Queen of Hearts, about Audrey Flack, the great artist, feminist and artist and photorealist, lives in East Hampton, New York, and someone who I knew when I was younger because she was a good friend of my mother's. And this is really a wonderful introduction to her. Now, I love the way you begin this film because you begin it with, it's more or less the present time, although this may have taken place a few years ago, but not way long ago. And she's in her studio. Put us there. What was her studio like and what was it like for you?
Well, her studio is fabulous. She has two studios, one in New York City and one in East Hampton, and they're similar. But even before we go to her studio, what drew me to Audrey in the first place is a friend had met her and become friends with her out in East Hampton and said, "I've met this woman. We have to make a film about her." And this friend and I had made a film about something entirely different before, about a poetry class in the South Bronx for at-risk youth. So she introduced me to Audrey, and I was very interested, as I've been making films for 50 years now, almost, I was interested in the problems of how do you keep going in your career? How do you just keep being creative and keep working? And so Audrey is, when I met her, was 85. I was just wowed by her. I fell in love with her. I mean, we had coffee. The first time I met her, we met in a coffee shop on the Upper West Side, and she told us, you know, a bit of the outlines of her story that you learn in the film about her childhood and her growing up and her education. And I just fell in love with her energy, her creativity, her ability to free associate. She's the most amazing teacher of art, but not just, it's more than art. It's really life lessons. I don't know. It sounds a little corny, but it's not pedantic ever. It's always, and she's always thinking. The thing that's, I think, is so amazing about her is she's always coming up with something new. I think she learned the banjo sometime in later in life. She's now a banjo player and has a band called the History of Art Band, which is something we didn't even manage to get in the film. She's totally, Audrey is capable in her 80s of saying, I'm going to learn something brand new that I've never done before. I'm going to try this thing. So that scene in the studio where we thought this film was going to unfold, Audrey had not been painting for nearly 40 years when we began the film. She had stopped painting and had become a sculptor and had done other things and had gone through recently a period of doing etchings and drawings and prints. And she had these two large canvases in her studio that she had prepared 40 years ago. She says she used to prepare her canvases with Chuck Close. And that's another long, we filmed a long description of how they prepared the canvas and gesso and sand and do it again. And they had to prepare a very shiny, hard surface for the photorealist work. But then the canvases just sat there unused for 40 years. And she suddenly said, I'm going to paint again. I don't even know if she said it. I think she just walked over to the canvas one day and started painting. So that's where we start the film. And that's where my idea, I thought, oh, good. We're gonna follow Audrey's comeback to painting. And I actually think I thought the film would be sort of more contemporaneous. But as things unfolded, of course, we ended up going back through her whole entire life, her career, her education, her family, her relationships, her, you know, being a woman in the 60s and 70s.
Right. And all of that is what I'd love to get into. But before we do, you do start the film, as you say, in her studio. There is this painting that she does go back to. And she says something that just grabs the viewer right away. She says, art cuts across time. And human beings need art because it helps us deal with our mortality. What do you think she meant by that?
I think she thinks it helps us make sense out of all the pain and the suffering and the joy that we deal with as human beings, that art, especially for Audrey, but I mean, for her creating it and for the rest of us, however we express ourselves or appreciating art, it's what helps us understand the human condition. It's what, you know, I guess the phrase that's sticks in my mind right now is, you know, it gets us through our grief. And as Audrey also tells us in the film, she had a lot of loss and complicated things to deal with in her life. And the art was both her anchor and her way to turn all of that into a form of expression. And I love, one of the things I just love about Audrey is how, you know, you think you're having an ordinary, like a cup of coffee with her, and suddenly she's talking about deep philosophical matters. And it's very genuine with her, you know, it just rolls right out of her. And I think that's part of what makes her such a great teacher, is that she's so open and she's so articulate. And in the case of that particular painting, you know, this was a whole new thing she was doing, was using a sort of a copy of an old painting as a kind of the basis for the painting, and then mixing it with new elements. I mean, she's literally showing us art that cuts across time. And the studio, you asked me before what the studio is like, actually, and I didn't answer that. The studio itself is huge, vast, and stuffed to the gills with her sculptures and other paintings. Audrey always has music on when she's painting. I used to have to ask her to turn it off because, you know, when you're doing an interview, you can't have music in the background because then you can't cut and paste so easily. So We tussle over that a few times, but and she listens to everything from bluegrass to Billie Holiday to symphonies. Her taste in music is as eclectic as her taste in everything else.
So now tell us a little bit about her background, about Audrey Flack's background. And I should say to our listeners that we are talking with Deborah Schaefer. She is the director of the documentary Queen of Hearts, which is about the life and work of the artist Audrey Flack. So again, so tell us a little bit about where did Audrey Flack come from?
Well, Audrey grew up, she was actually born in Brooklyn, but grew up mostly on the Upper West Side in Washington Heights in the Jewish neighborhood, but the old Jewish neighborhood pre-World War II. Her family had emigrated to the U.S. probably just before the turn of the century or early in the 1900s. So her parents themselves were immigrants. They were workers. They were not particularly highly educated, but they were from all the stories Audrey tells us, and we've included many of them in the film. They were very strong characters and obviously, you know, highly intelligent. And I think one of the funniest stories, and that was a big surprise, is that her mom was not just a card sharp, but her mom was actually a gambler. Her mom went off to these gambling parties, and according to Audrey, was arrested a few times, and she would just disappear for days sometimes. And Audrey did get into the film the story about her mother gambling away the food money. So her mother would send Audrey to the little store around the corner to get food and buy it on credit because she wouldn't have been able to pay. And Audrey revered her father. I think that comes through. And he was obviously a great support to her because as she's telling other stories, she said, you know, my father drove me the day she was taking the test to get into music and art high school. And when she was invited to have an interview at Yale, her father drove her up to Yale. So he was clearly a mainstay for her. And I think she was very devastated. He died when she was a young adult. She had graduated from college, but just barely. And he died very suddenly of a heart attack. And as she says in the film, I think it derailed her, and she married very quickly, not in the end what turned out to be a good marriage, and she suffered enormously for that.
And she had two children. Melissa was the first, and Hannah. Melissa's autistic, and it's very striking in the film. You know, this was the time that autism was completely misunderstood, and women, the mothers, were blamed. The idea of was the refrigerator mother, the idea that this was a mother who didn't care, and that's why the child was autistic. So talk about her experience through that. She obviously loves her daughter very, very much, and, you know, honors her spirit, but it was very difficult for her in the beginning.
I cannot imagine how terrible it must have been because the kind of, you know, social isolation she felt. I mean, you know, they would go to the playground and other mothers would keep their children away and they didn't want their children around Melissa. And people were very leery of anybody, you know, I mean, I think they still are really leery of people who are, quote, different or not, you know, conforming to the norm. And Melissa was, you know, physically, I think sometimes a handful, you know, very, she could only express herself physically. And
because she couldn't talk.
Right. She couldn't talk. So if she was frustrated, she would kick or, you know, hit out or lash out. I think it must have been such, I can only imagine. And also Audrey's husband was so, I assume, I never met him, but I assume he was just kind of really horrified by the situation. He would have nothing to do with Melissa, and he barely supported the family. She got divorced when Melissa was still pretty young. I mean, she did have another child 2 years later, Hannah, who was, you know, fortunately, you know, Hannah was completely a normal child, but then Audrey had two children, one of whom was autistic, and it was... It was a terribly, terribly difficult time for her. You know, a few close friends stuck by her. artists and her friend Anita, who's in the film, her childhood friend, who's a psychiatrist. We don't ever identify her as such in the film. They still speak on the phone every day.
That's so wonderful. And, you know, I just to say she did end up marrying a lovely man, her husband, Bob, when she divorced the first one, and he adopted the two kids. But let's move on to her work and her career as an artist. She went to Cooper Union and started out there as an abstract expressionist, as just about everybody else who was doing art at the time. But then she became what was, I think, first called a kind of super realist, but then photorealist. The only woman at that time in that group. Talk about super realism and how it was viewed by the art world.
Well, I'm not sure when the term actually super realism came in. We called it in the film, mostly people refer to first there was kind of a movement of realism, and she meets with her friend Philip Perlstein, who's we see a scene of them together in the film, and he's still painting, and he's a realist painter. And there were many subset of realist painters who were painting human figures and real objects that were recognizable. And Audrey gradually moved into photorealism. And as she explains to us, actually, in Audrey's case, it was a necessity because she couldn't get out of the house to paint with two young kids. So she started using photographs to copy from, just because, you know, as she says in the film, the kids wouldn't sit still, they wouldn't pose. And then she discovered, I love the line in the film where she said, you know, when she discovered, if you take a photograph, say, of a still life, you know, the candle never burns down, the fruit never gets rotten, the model doesn't twitch, run to the bathroom. So it was a way for her to fix what she wanted to paint. She could paint in the middle of the night when she got a few hours of peace and quiet, when the kids finally went to sleep, and Melissa didn't sleep a lot. And so Audrey became a photorealism. Really, it was, you know, it was a necessity for her, actually. And I don't know what impelled the other. She is sort of usually included in the group of the early photorealists of Chuck Close and Richard Estes. I don't know what impelled them. I don't know what their origin stories as photorealists are. It's certainly not the same as Audrey's.
Yeah, you know, I love, there's a part in the film which is film of her much younger at this point, where she's saying, I was, you know, the film at this point is talking about the use of light and how you recreate light and make it shine brilliantly in this kind of photorealism. And she says, yeah, but I wasn't interested in car fenders. What she was interested in were all the kinds of icons and trappings of what is seen as femininity. So talk about the subject of her art. You know, she says in the film, I'm not a feminist artist. I'm an artist who is a feminist. So why did she say it that way, and how did that inform her art?
I think that's actually Carrie Lovelace, who's a feminist art critic, says that about Audrey. I believe Carrie's writing a book about women artists of that era. But those were the things that that were around Audrey. You know, if she was painting from photographs and she was painting the objects around her, she has a painting of a Jell-O box. And she has a painting of her dressing table and Audrey is still very attracted to, you know, when she buys jewelry, she buys giant baubles and it's very glittery, glitzy. Just, she's like, I guess, I don't mean this in any insulting way. You know how magpies are attracted to things that glitter, and Audrey is attracted to glitter and guilt and the Baroque, and that comes through very strongly also when she talks about the Macarena, the paintings she did that were inspired by the sculpture, the Luisa Rodin sculpture of Mary Magdalene in Spain. Audrey did a series of paintings, and they're full of gold leaf and intricate lace detail. And
the Madonna paintings, yes. So it's not just baubles. I mean, she's really talking about a certain kind of, she's making a comment. I mean, those paintings, and then another series, Vanitas, which is like the Vanitas paintings of the 17th century, say the Dutch Golden Age, you know, that are making points about how culture views the feminine and how this is a woman's eye looking at how the culture views women.
Absolutely. And I think Audrey was a little taken aback. One of the other art critics, Robert Storr, says that she overtly defies good taste. And I'm not sure that Audrey ever really thought about it that way before, but I think she does, in the sense that, and she does say in the film, like when she became a sculptor, she didn't want to make art just for an elite, for some sort of like rarefied group of people. She wanted to make art that anybody could appreciate, that, you know, that masses of people would go see and could understand and could relate to and could say, you know, through thinking that something was pretty or beautiful or recognizing the objects in a painting, could then enter into, you know, why are we seeing these things together? Like the Wheel of Fortune painting, which has lots of beads and a goblet and a candle, but it's also got a skull. And it's also got a picture of Melissa, and it's also got a tarot card.
Right, right. It is very much part of that vanitas. I have a little story about that, because that was, it was after, probably several years after that was painted, but I went to visit Audrey Flack because she had asked my mother, and my mother related to me, if I could do a tarot reading of her. I used to do things like that back in my 30s. So I went and I did a tarot reading in her studio, and that painting was there, and she pointed it out to me. I've never forgotten. That's kind of the image that I have in my head of visiting Audrey Flack in her studio. And it is a wonderful, wonderful painting.
It was just a great image. It's a great image of you doing the tarot card, which I don't even remember which card is in that painting. Do you remember?
It is the Wheel of Fortune.
That's the name of the painting. Oh, is that what that tarot card is called?
That's the Wheel of Fortune. Yes, exactly. I don't remember if that came up in the reading, however. And then she stopped painting for many, many years. And instead, she turned to sculpture. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, there was a controversy about her. She created these massive sculptures of goddesses, really, you'd have to say. And one of them was a colossus that was supposed to go, is that right, in the East River?
Yes, on the Queen's side of the East River, facing the UN building.
Right. So, and there was a whole controversy about that. What happened?
That was Queen Catherine. That statue is cool. We refer to it as Queen Catherine because it was Queen Catherine of Braganza, who was the Portuguese queen who had been married to King Charles of England. And Queen Catherine, apparently, I didn't know this till I made this movie, Kings County, which is Brooklyn, where I live now, is named after King George, and Queens County is named after Queen Catherine. So the Portuguese friends of, a bunch of Portuguese businessmen and political figures dubbed themselves the Friends of Queen Catherine, and raised money to create this enormous statue. Audrey won a competition to create this statue that they wanted to do something like what the French had done with the Statue of Liberty. This was, I think, their idea. It wasn't actually going to be as big as the Statue of Liberty, but maybe a third. I mean, you would have seen it across the river. And it was going to be lit up at night. The renderings are phenomenal of this. And Audrey worked on it really over a period of 10 years. And it became very controversial. It became a lightning rod. It was very unfortunate because I think Audrey was really caught up in something that she had no part of and didn't even really see it coming. She was blindsided by it. She still is, I think it would be fair to say. But because the Portuguese, this group, had decided on this statue and had somehow gotten this land donated from the city, or I don't know how they had it worked, but they hadn't asked anybody. They had asked nobody's opinion. They hadn't asked the Queen's Historical Society or any of the other political groups in Queens. And it was, I guess, where are we in time now? I can't, off the top of my head, I can't place the year. But, you know, a historian who we do interview in the film wrote an essay talking about how Queen Catherine was Portuguese, and Portuguese had been a slave owning Portugal as a country had profited from the slave trade. And why were we honoring anyway a king and a queen in, you know, post
colonial
76 America? Why were we honoring King George and Queen Catherine as opposed to, you know? So it just became mired in controversy. The African American community came out strongly in opposition. The Irish community came out in opposition. The Jewish community was opposed. It just became such a political football that it had to get, the project had to get killed. And it's really, I mean, it's a tragedy for Audrey personally to have worked 10 years on this and have this, the parts melted down. There are examples of it. At the Butler Museum in Youngstown, Ohio, there's a, not the full size, but I think it's a, maybe a 10-foot plaster maquette that's quite impressive. And there is also on the waterfront in Portugal, there was a casting of a smaller, probably also 10 feet. It is on the waterfront in a park in Lisbon, which is very nice and appropriate.
And we're running out of time here. So I wanted to ask you about the way you ended the film, because in the film, she goes back to a painting that she hadn't done for like 40 years, I think you talked about. She finishes it. You see the film being carried out, and then you see her putting up a new, massive, totally blank canvas. Talk about that moment.
Well, I was in her studio, and I forget what we were doing there, and she kind of waved her hand in front of that canvas. And I got chills when I saw it. Just, I was in the room with her and my camera woman was filming. And I guess I kind of knew that, I didn't know that that was actually going to be the last shot of the movie, but I knew that that was the idea we had to end the movie with. She was going to make a new painting. And going back to where I was starting, you know, where I started, why did I want to make this movie? You know, how does an artist live? How does an artist continue their life? Artists don't get to retire. So, and you know what? Artists don't want to retire. I don't want to retire. I mean, people ask me when I travel, oh, do you still work? You know, they have no idea what I do. And I'm like, what do you mean? I mean, it's my life, and it's Audrey's life. And that was my kind of like initial personal connection to it. But I love that last shot.
Yes, and it is just an extraordinary film. Queen of Hearts, Audrey Flack, a wonderful documentary. Thank you so much, Deborah Schaefer, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It was really fun.
Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the website for Queen of Hearts and to find out where the film is being screened. For listeners on the East End of Long Island, Queen of Hearts will play at the Parish Art Museum on March 6, 2020. Next up, we have a fascinating conversation with Rachel Reichman, who edited and co-directed Queen of Hearts, about the process of editing documentaries, and Queen of Hearts in particular. Stay tuned after the break.
Sometimes it takes a rainy day just to let you know everything's gonna be
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In our first segment today, we spoke with filmmaker Deborah Schaefer about her documentary about the pioneering artist and feminist Audrey Flack. Now, let's hear my conversation with Rachel Reichman, the film's editor and co-producer, who gives us a close-up view of the process of editing the film and documentaries in general. Oh, Rachel Reichman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
So you are the editor of the film about Audrey Flack, Queen of Hearts. First, tell us, what does a film editor do?
Well, I would have to talk for a few hours to tell you what a film editor does, but I will try to sum it up in a couple of sentences. I do think the role is a little different in documentary versus narrative. Obviously, there's lots of overlap. But in the documentaries, generally, the editors are a little more involved in storytelling, often a lot more involved. In terms of structure, small choices, orders of language and ideas and story points within scenes, but also in the bigger overall structure of the film itself. So that's in general. But in the project that I just did with Deb, that was something that I did much more of. I have a lot of experience working with really strong writers. The last big film I did was called Hitchcock Truffaut. And I was working with Kent Jones, who's a very well-known and well-loved film critic. He also ran the New York Film Festival for many, many years. But he had a very strong voice and very a lot of strength as a writer. He's really, really good. And so he led the way on that. And, you know, I weighed in. And that actually leads me to the second thing I would say about an editor. Well, actually, I guess there's two more things I'd say. But the second thing I was thinking of was that I began to realize after years of editing that it really bore a strong resemblance to an editor of a book or of a magazine articles, long form, that I became very acutely aware of structure and the unfurling of ideas, you know, dramatically, and your lead and your thesis and repetition of ideas. And, you know, the thing that I'm sure, though I've never done any journalist editing, I could really see there is an overlap, being that I love, for instance, the long articles in The New Yorker, the long journalist pieces. And I've thought to myself, oh, I can really learn from the way they build these stories. And so I think that does overlap with what we do as editors. The third thing, of course, is often, especially in documentary, and depending on the team, an editor is extremely instrumental in the visuals, in the language of the visuals, the order of the visuals, the choice, because we probably had a couple thousand still photographs, for instance, for the film we're speaking about today, Queen of Hearts. And the final film did have 500 photos in it, but I was involved partly in the archival research. But even if I hadn't been, to take those 2,000 or 3,000 images and pick the ones that work and put them in the order they work, that's what makes the difference between one editor and another.
Yeah, you know, I was very struck by the structure of how the film is structured. You begin Queen of Hearts with Audrey Flack in her studio, and you set who she is, not who she is in terms of her fame, because that unrolls, but the central beliefs that form the core of her art. And then you go through her life and, you know, her place in the feminist artist movement, in the feminist movement, in the photorealist movement, in the abstract expressionist movement that was even earlier. And you end with a blank canvas, which was a wonderful touch. Were you the one who chose that to end in that place?
Well, I would have to say yes. Possibly if Deb was on her own, you know, or whatever, she might have suggested that. And, you know, to her credit, Deb was responsible for shooting the material. And so she got that. But sure, I placed it there, and I'm glad it worked as well as it did. And I appreciate your thoughts on structure. What I will say is that we wrestled very hard with the structure for quite a while. The luxury we had was that, you know, we didn't have a venue, so we didn't have a deadline, which is kind of terrifying. It's like free-falling a little bit, but it also gives you the freedom to keep working. And we did, you know, and we spent quite a bit of time. We did a lot of screenings. Not a huge amount, but we did small screenings with filmmakers and people we've known for a long time that we really trusted, who were brutally honest with us. And for a while, we had a very, 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 very boring film. And we just kept going and experimenting and trying other things and trying to read. You know, the thing about filmmaking is you have to read between the lines when people tell you something isn't right, because they will tell you something may not work, or there's a place where it's boring, or they fell asleep or got distracted or whatever. And they may even tell you why. And it could have nothing to do with that exact moment in the film. So you've got to figure out where the problem is.
So could you give an example of something that happened with the film that way?
Oh, wow. Let me just think for a sec. Well, actually, the one that for me is really still kind of amazing. You know, we have a little scene with Esther Williams. Do you remember that?
Not by name.
Okay. Esther Williams is a Busby Berkeley 1930s movie star who was formerly an Olympic champion.
Oh, yes. The one who dove into a pool from a trapeze.
Yes. And she is a former Olympic champion who Audrey mentions as a child. She adored her. She was a hero of Audrey's. And, you know, our film was built, we built it chronologically. And it actually used to start with my father. I was born in Brooklyn and my father was a polar bear swimmer. And we have this fantastic footage of these polar bear swimmers from the 1930s in Brooklyn, you know, which are the guys in their little funny 1930s swimming suits out there in the middle of winter, chipping holes in the ice to go swimming. And we thought this was extraordinary. This was a great way to, you know, get into Audrey's story. And of course, it's gone, you know, and that's, but the point about Esther Williams is for the longest time, that was chronologically at the beginning of the film where it began, you know, not the very beginning, but, you know, somewhere in her childhood. And what, you know, I taught editing not too long ago. And one of the reference books that I use is Walter Murchett, writes a lot of great stuff about editing. And, you know, I'd never read his sort of 5 points, the key points that he, in order of importance of why you make an edit and what drives a cut and a structure. And the first one is emotion. It has nothing to do with the graphic movement. It has nothing to do with the aesthetics or the speed or the tempo or anything. It has to do strictly with the emotion of that moment. And it sort of stuck in my mind. And so what I realized for the longest time was we were going to lose the Esther Williams moment. But instead, we realized it really belonged at the middle or the relatively early in the third act, which is close to the end of the film, which is in Skull.
Right. And it is absolutely perfect there. You know, I remember, you know, I looked at that and I thought, oh, you know, first of all, it's so interesting itself. I mean, visually, it's, you know, so stunning. And then it links visually so beautifully with Audrey Flack's sculpture. And the fact that now we are going back to her childhood adds more interest to it.
Yes. Yeah. And basically that, you know, our core inspirations, and one might say as artists, there are core fears, our core traumas, but also our core joys and excitement and the things that stirred us as children, they will, and often in many cases, especially for artists, just drive us our whole lives.
Yes, which of course is what that did for Audrey Flack. So I have to say, as a writer myself, I really struggle with structure. And as a radio reporter, when I was producing features, it really took me quite a few years. Now it's a lot easier, but I'm also not doing that many features. But when I do, they just roll out easily. But I used to struggle so much with what goes where and where do I start. And, you know, that was the hardest part of it. Are there a few kind of guidelines that you use? I mean, you just said emotion, for example. What are some other kind of touchstones for you in the editing process?
Well, I do generally think, and of course, none of this is hard and fast. Otherwise, if it was, this wouldn't be so hard. You know, it's like it wouldn't be hard for Hollywood studios to come up with formulas. I mean, they have formulas for some kinds of movies, but in general, what makes a great film, be it doc or narrative, nobody knows the formula. If they did, every film would be great. And so for us, you know, it's a huge amount of experimentation. That said, generally you don't build the open and the close until the film is pretty far along. You know, you can get pretty close to the end. And that's when you start, because the extraordinary thing about a documentary is you can have an agenda about what the film is about. And of course, certainly you pick your subject and it will be the subject. But in terms of what the film is really about, its essence, its themes, its thesis, its emotional arc, I think actually to make a decent film, you need to put aside your preconceived ideas and you must simply allow yourself to see what's in the can, so to speak, on the digital card, we would say now, and the SD card. And in fact, that's part of the reason bringing in somebody, like in my case, I didn't meet Audrey for a long time. I really needed some distance to help Deb, because Deb had most of the film in the can when I came on board. You know, I was not the co-director from the very beginning, and I became the co-director as we began building the film. But you know, you really need some objectivity. So I would say being able to put aside all your preconceived ideas and just deal with what's there, which is not easy, is absolutely crucial. I also think, you know, you need a thesis. You need to establish something that's almost like a question at the very beginning of the film. And you know, if you're National Geographic, you say, why did the Aztecs, you know, build that pyramid in the middle of that jungle? And then you spend the next hour figuring, you know, talking about it. Or why did those dinosaurs disappear at that moment, prehistorically? And we don't want to do that. What we want to do is ask questions in other ways that provoke the audience member to want to go on this journey with you. Because everybody's got way too much to do. So even though it's only 75 minutes, you know, you're still asking something of your audience and you want them to be engaged. So there are many ways to do that. And, you know, Audrey's this extremely interesting person and she's so articulate. She's so funny. She's so smart. She's so book smart. And she's also a really provocative and interesting artist. And some people think she's a great artist, some people don't. But no matter what, you know, so you have to establish all that. And then the other thing is Audrey's not a household name. And so we had to do, as you know, a little moment that says, at this moment in time, people were paying very close attention to this artist.
You know, it's so interesting what you say there, because Chuck Close is mentioned, and of course he is a household name, at least I would say in New York. You know, you can go on the Second Avenue subway and you can see his, you know, he was chosen to do those wonderful murals in the subway. But Audrey Flack is easily his equal, I would say, as an artist. So do you ascribe this to the fact that she is a woman artist?
You know what? I don't think this stuff is simple. I don't think the art market is so tidy. There is no question, and obviously we make that case, that women artists were not given the recognition that male artists were. It was very hard, but that's not by any means the only thing our film is about. I think, you know, that's one of the reasons, and I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, some of the things, the ideas that are some of the writers and other critics and curators talk about in our film, you know, we don't have, as you know, a lot of talking heads, but we sort of selectively found the voices we felt helped us. And, you know, we let Audrey tell the story. But, you know, it's a fickle world, the art market. I think there are certain boxes Chuck Close checked. You know, Chuck Close also, he fit into more boxes than she did. I think it's very interesting because she is unquestionably, at least the work that put her on the map first and foremost, which is the photorealist work. Though, of course, the sculpture later is well known and is seen. The photorealist work made her a celebrity in that moment in time. I don't think people would even say Chuck Close is a photorealist. I don't think they think of him that way. I mean, they might, but I think they might consider him, and I'm not an art historian, so I may get this wrong, but more of a minimalist. You know, there's something in the grid. There's something in the simplicity. There's something, there was a moment, a different kind of exploration going on there in the questions about photography versus painting that were different than what Audrey was doing. And one thing we do speak very much about is the subject matter. You know, Audrey's doing subject matter that's a little less, that somehow just didn't cross over it. Whereas the chalk portraits really did. And I think some of that is intellectual.
A society which devalues women's topics in some way. But I wanted to get back to something you said just before, which was about the questions. Would it be giving anything away for you to say what you saw as one or two of the central questions that you are asking in this film?
Well, you know, when Audrey says, you know, art helps us cope with our mortality because we're all going to die. I mean, that's a question. Does it?
Yes. And in fact, that is one of my first questions. And I have asked that of Deborah. So I'll ask that of you. What do you think she meant by that?
Well, actually, that's exactly what I was thinking is I think it's not tidy precisely what she means. Which is, that's where, when I said a moment ago that, you know, I feel that a filmmakers offer up a question at the beginning, inherently in the beginning of a film, often, and though it's not an obvious question. So in our case, the question might be, the questions might be, is it true that art helps us deal with our mortality? And the other question might be, what on earth could that mean? Which I think is what you're asking me, right?
Yeah, I mean, I have a sense of what it could mean, different things. I mean, it could mean something as simple as your art endures after you die.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But what I also think, especially in Audrey's case, is the fundamental, the challenges of life itself. And, you know, in our film, we do then go forward to spell out a handful of the challenges that Audrey dealt with, which are pretty big doozies. But all of us deal with variations of those things. You know, very few people escape without some hardship. And it's rough. And if you are sensitive, which all of us to one degree or another are, those can be devastating. And if you're going to pick yourself up and keep going, or more than that, avail yourself to the joys and enlightenment of what could be available. Maybe enlightenment is not the right word, but, you know, the joy of just the experience of living, whether it be light and family and nature and art. So that's where we get this other bridge into what Audrey's talking about in the very, very beginning, what I would say the introduction to our film. You know, she's talking about art cuts across time. And that to me is very directly connected to this idea that it helps us deal with our mortality in more than one way. One, that's why people kept making art. Two, there is something very, very profound about witnessing art that we connect to that moves us.
Yes, certainly does. Well, Rachel Reichman, it's just been a pleasure to talk with you. You are the editor of the film, editor and co-director of Queen of Hearts, a documentary film about the great artist, Audrey Flack. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel Reichman has edited scores of prize-winning documentaries, including Hitchcock, Truffaut, A Letter to Elia, and Women, War, and Peace. As this episode of Writer's Voice is being produced, the Nevada caucus is just a few days away. Concerns about how our votes are counted have already been heightened by the Iowa caucus debacle. Today, I saw on Twitter a claim that at some early voting sites in Nevada, in Latino and African American areas, voters were not being informed that they needed to sign their caucus cards, rendering their vote useless. I can't confirm that account, but it's clear that there are many ways U.S. elections have of suppressing the vote or denying it outright. One of the most egregious is purging the voter rolls. That's what happened in Georgia in 2018 when the Republican Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, who was overseeing the election, ran for governor and won by the slimmest of margins. He had purged the voter rolls of many thousands of voters, many of them young, African American, or Latino, voters whose likely choice was the Democrat, Stacey Abrams. Investigative journalist Greg Palast has often been a guest on our show talking about voter suppression. He just won a major court ruling in Georgia to force Governor Kemp to release all records pertaining to the 2018 voter purge. I caught up with Palast this week for an extended conversation that appears online at writersvoice.net. But here's an excerpt from that interview. Apologies for the tinny sound, but you'll have no trouble hearing what he says. You filed suit against Brian Kemp, governor of Georgia, and you did that along with civil rights activist Helen Butler. Tell us about the suit. Why did you sue, and what did you sue to get?
I was been hunting down Brian Kemp, the guy who's currently governor. He was Secretary of State, and for 6 years I was hunting him down for Rolling Stone, Al Jazeera, Democracy Now!, and currently The Guardian. And it was clear to me that in Georgia is where you have the Petri dish for the system to figure out how to steal the 2020 election. Now, understand, Brian Kemp was the Secretary of State in charge of voter rolls, voting, who gets to vote, how you get the vote, while he is running for governor. And by the way, he's the Republican. While he's running the election, he's the Republican running for governor against Stacey Abrams. Stacey Abrams is the first black woman ever to run for governor in the United States. So the race had a lot of national attention. I've been hunting Brian Kemp for 6 years as a guy who's specialized in removing black voters from the voter rolls. Before the election, he removed 500,000 voters from the voter rolls. Let me repeat that. The guy who's running for governor as Secretary of State removes more than 500,000 people from the voter rolls. Now, I wanted his inside documents. So he stonewalled me for years under the Freedom of Information Act. So I got a wonderful lawyer out of New York, Jeannie Meyer, and local counsel in Atlanta, voting rights lawyer Brian Spears. And they said, well, let's use the National Voter Registration Act, basically voting rights protection law, to open up this politician's files. So we filed a federal lawsuit. And when I say we, me, and I was joined locally by Helen Butler, who is with the campaign for the Georgia Campaign for a People's Agenda, which was founded by the great civil rights icon, Reverend Joseph Lowry, who is still with us, who I spoke to, by the way. And he said, you know, I explained to him removing all these voters. It's Jim Crow all over again. So I sued to open up the files. First, he gave us his purge list, and I'll tell you what we did with that. He gave us names and addresses of the people he removed. But he still stonewalled the files relating to his secret relationship with another Secretary of State, another Republican in charge of voter rolls, who's called Chris Kobach of Kansas. Now, I've been covering votes. This is Greg Palast. I've been covering vote suppression for 20 years, and Chris Kobach is the only official I've ever said is a white supremacist, and he is. So I sued, and I said, I want all these files where the state of Georgia is involved in removing voters in other states, and I'm talking Michigan, Ohio, Kansas, Arizona, Indiana, Illinois, removing voters from the voter rolls. This is how Trump is going to be reelected in 2020, not by the voters, but by these purge systems. So in the lawsuit, I wanted all this information. Now, Kemp, this is very unusual in court of law, Kemp's lawyers and tried to dismiss my case, Palast v. Kemp, and with Helen Butler. And the court not only said, I'm not dismissing your case, the case against you, Mr. Kemp, governor, but you have lost. I'm going to order this you to open your files. Basically, it's a legal action called sua sponte by a judge. It almost never happens. We didn't ask the judge for a summary judgment against Brian Kemp of Georgia, but the judge simply said, you've lost. Greg Palast does not have to go to trial. You've already lost. Because basically she was pissed off at Kemp for lying to the court, saying he didn't have files. He wasn't involved in these disputes in the removing voters in other states. But he was. And therefore, so the judge did this extraordinary thing, saying you don't have to go to trial. Kemp lied. You've won. Turn over your files.
And these files are from something called CrossCheck, which was developed by Chris Kobach. You talked about it in your film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And CrossCheck had another judgment against it, that it was determined to disproportionately impact voters of color. Is that right?
In the state of Indiana, yes. So what happened is, if you've seen my film or read my Rolling Stone reports, Interstate CrossCheck is a system set up by Chris Kobach of Kansas, who you might know as kind of Trump's vote thief in chief. I'm being blunt about it. He's the guy that Trump put in charge of the so-called vote fraud commission, which imploded again when we asked for the inside documents on this commission. Anyway, so Kobach came up with this system with Brian Kemp of saying, we're going to check if people are registered in two states or voting in two states. Now, that's a federal crime. About roughly one person a year out of a third of a billion Americans is convicted of voting twice in a single election. So I said, well, how many people are on this suspect list of double voters? 12, 15? No, the answer is, are you ready? 7.2 million Americans. 7.2 million Americans are on the cross-check suspect list because you are suspected of voting or registering in two different states in the same election. Now, who's on this list? In Georgia, Georgia gave out to other secretaries of state a list of guys, of 568 guys named James Brown, who he said were registered in another state. Believe it or not, they found a James Brown in Atlanta and a James Brown in Detroit, a James Brown in Baltimore, and you know, James Brown in Chicago. And they said, oh, all these have to be the same James Brown voting again and again. I actually confronted the Secretary of State of Michigan in their office, and I said, do you think that James Brown might be a common black name? Their answer was, well, I know a lot of white Browns. Well, it's okay then. So they're removing people named Brown and Jose Garcia, you know, and Juan Rodriguez and David Kim from the voter rolls for having voted twice, except that it's Michael Allen Brown and Michael Bennett Brown. These are real examples from that they said are the same voter. Almost none of them had the same middle name. They matched James Brown Jr., James Brown Sr. So it's all phony. So the ACLU sued and said this was highly discriminatory and wrong. In Indiana, and an Indiana judge stopped the use of, supposedly suspended the use of cross-check in Indiana, though my legal team found that they continued to remove people.
Greg Palast, investigative reporter for The Guardian and author of numerous books, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, as well as a film version of that book. Be sure to go to writersvoice.net for the remainder of our interview with him and for important links that will help you find out whether your voter registration has been purged. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.